Certainly it's good to see everyone here today. We're especially appreciative of those who are visiting with us. As has been mentioned, if you are here for the first time, we'd ask that you please fill out a visitor's card and stick around a little bit afterwards so that we'd have a chance to get to know you a little bit. If you have an opportunity again to meet with us, we would invite you and be glad that you are here. As has been stated, George is out of town this week doing a series of lessons in Seminole, and I'm happy that I've had the opportunity to fill in for him this morning. I do wonder that Randall mentioned that George was our normal preacher. What does that make me? Don't answer that. When one reads the Bible, in fact, even if one looks at secular history, what we find is that the history of man is often a story of man's contrariness with God. What does it mean to be contrary? Well, to be contrary is to be in opposition or obstinate to an idea or directive. We all have known someone, perhaps know someone at this time, who no matter what position you take on any issue, they're going to take the opposite, just so that they have a chance to be different or a chance to argue. Or it may be the idea of being an example where you offer someone something, yet they always want something else. They just simply want something different. It's kind of frustrating with a child, for example, when they come in and they're whining because they want something to drink. So you give them some milk. Well, I don't want milk. I want Kool-Aid. And then later on, they come in whining again. So you give them some more Kool-Aid. I don't want Kool-Aid. I want milk. It seems whatever it is, they want the opposite. Or whatever issue that is stated, they take the opposite position. Jesus met up with some people like this, I believe, in Matthew chapter 11, beginning in verse 16. Where he tells a story, we read the story, but to what shall I liken this generation, talking about the people of his day? He said, it's like children sitting in the marketplace and calling to their companions and saying, we played the flute for you, and you did not dance. We mourned to you, and you did not lament. For John came, neither eating nor drinking, and they say, he has a demon. The Son of Man came, eating and drinking, and they say, look, a gluttonous man and a winebibber, a friend of tax collectors and sinners. But wisdom is justified by her children. So here we have a group of individuals who complain that one prophet has this characteristics. And so another one comes along with the kind of characteristics they seem to want. And they say, no, we don't want that either. And so people are just not satisfied. Dealing with contrary people can be very frustrating. Especially when the contrary person should, by all rights, be in subjection or obedient to the one with whom they are being contrary. For example, we already mentioned the parent and the child relationship, where the parent is telling the child that he needs to do such and such, yet they are being obstinate, they're being contrary, they want to do something else. And we think about the boss and his subordinate, that no matter what directive the boss gives, the subordinate wants to do something else or he's not satisfied. And in particular, we see it difficult when in the God-man relationship, when God has given certain demands, God has given certain directives, and man says, I don't want to do it that way, I want to do it my way. And it is this God-man relationship that we wish to examine today. And we are going to begin in our lesson by looking at a man by the name of Nimrod. So if you will now, let's turn over to Genesis chapter 10 and verse 8. Genesis chapter 10 and verse 8. If you're familiar with the Bible story, God has destroyed mankind with a flood. The only ones that were saved were Noah, his three sons, and their wives, and of course Noah's wife. And so after the flood, they land on Mount Ararat, and they are then commanded that they are now to replenish the earth. They are to repopulate the earth. And so a few generations go on, we begin reading in chapter 10, what some have called the Table of Nations. That is, we see the descendants of the three sons of Noah and the nations that they become. And I want us to begin now in verse 8. And we notice that Cush begot Nimrod. And he began to be a mighty one in the earth. He was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Therefore it is said, like Nimrod, the mighty hunter before the Lord. Well, who was Nimrod? Well, If you read through here, you find that he was the great-grandson of Noah. And here he is described in a number of ways, and we want to look at the character of Nimrod for a little bit. The Bible tells us, at least the King James Version tells us, is that in verse 8, he was a mighty one. Well, that word mighty can have several different meanings. In fact, the characteristics that we're going to see about him can be taken in a good way, or it can be taken in a bad way. And I think how we determine who Nimrod was will explain more the story of the Tower of Babel that we'll get to in just a moment. But it says of Nimrod that he was a mighty one on earth. What exactly does that mean? Well, it could mean that he was a warrior, that he was a man of strength, that he is one who led his people into battle. Could mean that he was a hero. In fact, many look at it this way, that he was a hero of the people, a protector of the people. Or it could mean, now in the negative sense, that here was a man who became a tyrant. Over in Genesis chapter 6, verse 4, if we go back and we read there, we find that the people on earth had gotten so bad, had become so evil, that now God is wanting to destroy them. And he does so with the flood. In Genesis chapter 6, verse 4, we find a description of these people that now have gotten to a point that God is to destroy them. He says there were giants on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God came in to the daughters of men, and they bore children to them. Those were the mighty, notice here we have the same word, those were the mighty men who were of old, men of renown. We've studied this passage before in past lessons. And we find that in these words that we find not people who were necessarily only strong and tall and whatever, but these were men who were tyrants. They were brutes. They were people who brutalized their fellow man. And so perhaps here as we look at this individual Nimrod, we find not so much a hero or a mighty warrior, but we find a tyrant. He is also described down in verse 10, I believe it is, verse 9, he was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Again, we have this word mighty, but now added to it is this word hunter. Some suggest here that as the people in that time were now subject to the many wild animals that were about, that the one who was considered the warrior, the hero, was the one who would protect the people from these mighty animals. Well, that could be the case, but it also has the idea in this word that he was one who preys on his fellow men. He is one who enslaves them and bends them to his will, causing them for him to be seen again as a tyrant, but a man who now is who preys on other men, those who are weaker, and bends them to his will. But it also says in that same phrase that he was a mighty hunter before the Lord. Well, what does this mean? Well, the word literally means that it was to the face. So the question is here, was he a man that with whom God was so impressed with his hunting skills? Seems kind of odd that God would be concerned about someone's a prowess in hunting. Seems a bit trivial. But if we take this idea that it is to his face, some suggest then that what it's saying here is that here is a tyrant, a man who is opposed to God and who gets into the face of God. In other words, he does these evil things in the very sight of God in a very contemptuous manner. In fact, one of the lexicographers of the Hebrew and Chaldean language says of this particular word, it can be taken to mean to say and do anything to anyone's face, freely, frankly, and even often impudently and insolently in contempt of him. So we're getting a picture here of an individual who perhaps now is a tyrant, one who preys on his fellow man, and who has great contempt for God, and who goes through these actions in the very face of God, almost with the attitude, God, let you do something about it. It's interesting that Josephus, the first century Jewish historian, mentions Nimrod. Notice what he has to say about him. He says, now it was Nimrod who excited them, talking about the people, to such an affront and contempt of God. He was the grandson of Ham, the son of Noah, a bold man and of great strength of Ham. He persuaded them not to ascribe it to God, as if it was through his means they were happy, but to believe that it was their own courage which procured that happiness. He also gradually changed the government into tyranny, seeing no other way of turning men from the fear of God, but to bring them into a constant dependence on his power. So here's a man who we might say was willing to spit in the face of God and to teach the people that their happiness comes not from God, but it will come from following this man, this tyrant. In Genesis chapter 10 and verse 10, we continue reading about Nimrod. We find that he established what the Bible records for us as the very first kingdom of men on earth. It consisted of several cities. The city of Babel, which later becomes Babylon. Erech, Akkad, and Calneh in the land of Shinar. Shinar is that land between the Tigris and Euphrates River that was very fertile. In fact, we'll see in just a moment that the people apparently at one point left the mount of Ararat, where they had developed into a quite large population, and now have come down and found a very fertile valley in which they could live in. But not only that, it also shows that he built Nineveh, Rehoboth, Calah, and Rezin in Assyria. Kind of interesting then that we find this man who perhaps is an enemy of God builds two cities that later on become very important in the dealings with God's people, the city of Babylon and the city of Nineveh. Well, let's continue on now. Let's look over at chapter 11, where we now get to this tower that these individuals built. It says, "Now the whole earth," beginning in verse 1, "had one language and one speech. And it came to pass, as they journeyed from the east, that they found a plain in the land of Shinar, and they dwelt there. Then they said to one another, 'Come, let us make bricks and bake them thoroughly.' They had brick for stone, and they had asphalt for mortar. And they said, 'Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower whose top is in the heaven. Let us make a name for ourselves, lest we scatter abroad over the face of the whole earth.'" So now we come to what we commonly refer to as the Tower of Babel. And I want us to notice, first of all, that this tower that was being built, in fact, the language suggests when they say, "Let us build a city and a tower," they're saying, "Let us build a city and especially a tower." The tower is to be the focal point of this endeavor. But what we notice here is that it was not God's desire that they built this city, but rather it was man's desire that they built it. Perhaps Nimrod, at this point, was in leadership. And now he is building this city. And we find then also a reason for it. Well, first of all, let's notice how he describes it. He described it in chapter 11 and verse 4 as a city that would reach up to the heavens. There are several suggestions as to what this might mean. Some suggest, and perhaps this is the truth, that they're simply saying, "Let's make this a very tall building. That we're going to build one that reaches way up into the sky." Some suggest there is a more, what we might say, evil intent in this idea. And that is, if the character of Nimrod is as we have suggested, that this is actually, in this building and building it to heaven, it is an assault on God himself. Again, an effort to get in God's face. We're going to build this tower and we're going to build it into God's domain. We're going to show him who's boss. Some suggest that it was an attempt to reach the gods or to involve themselves in astrological idolatry. Many centuries later, other towers were built in this particular area in the land of Babylon. And they're called ziggurats. And what these were tall towers ranging anywhere from perhaps two stories all the way up to seven stories. On the very top, they have found things like temples or sanctuaries, and inside they'd find symbols of the zodiac. In other words, these were being built up into the heavens so that they might worship the constellations and worship the stars and the various gods that they believed to exist there. So they built this tower up to the heavens. But we find now the reasons for it. And again, we suggest that it was not God's desire that they build it, but it was man's. And what was their desire? Well, their desire was to make a name for themselves. They say in chapter 11 and verse 4, let us make a name for ourselves. It's not just simply a monument, but it's a way to achieve fame and renown. Remember over in Daniel chapter 3, verses 1 through 7, that Nebuchadnezzar had put into his mind that he was going to build this great image. Many suggest that it's supposedly an image of himself. And that any time that the music was played, any time that the horns were blown, that people were to bow down to this image. Perhaps the same idea is being presented here. That in this tower they were building something that people would then recognize the greatness of those who built it. And particularly if it was Nimrod. That he's now in an effort to make himself, if you will, a god. I missed a point, but we'll go back and we'll just give it now. One of the things I wanted to point out, how do we know about what character that Nimrod had? One of the things I failed to point out was that his name means the rebel. And so it may be that his name was not actually Nimrod, but actually it was the characteristic or the character of the individual that people are referencing when they say Nimrod. So then here we see, as he's building this thing, instead of going to God, I want you to come to me, and this tower is going to represent my power. But not only that, the purpose of building this tower was lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth. Again, let's look at verse 4 of chapter 11. Come, let us build ourselves a city and a tower whose top is in the heavens. Let us make a name for ourselves, lest we be scattered abroad over the face of the whole earth. That is, that they wanted to keep the people together. They did not want people to spread out, but I need to keep them under my control. We need to stay together. And so they built this tower. And now we come to the point where we see the individual who is contrary to God. Because while they wanted to stay together and not to be spread out, what did God want? But God said, back in chapter 9 and verse 1, he said in chapter 9, verse 1, so God blessed Noah and his sons and said to them, be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth. God's desire for man was to spread out and to populate the entire earth. But now we have this group of people who built a tower, and they said, we are building it so that we don't spread out, but that we will stay together. We do not want to scatter out over the earth, in direct conflict with the desire that God had for man. Well, in Genesis chapter 11, verses 5 through 9, we see that now God intervenes in this. Let's begin reading chapter 11, verse 5. But the Lord came down to see the city and the tower which the sons of men had built. And the Lord said, indeed, the people are one, and they have all one language. And this is what they begin to do. Now nothing that they propose to do will be withheld from them. Kind of a difficult passage right there, a difficult idea. Is God saying here that man can do whatever he wants to do? More likely the idea that is, if we let him get away in this, then he'll never come back. That he'll always go after his own pleasures and never listen to God. And so we know the stories. We continue reading. Verse 7, come, let us go down there and confuse their language that they may not understand one another's speech. So the Lord scattered them abroad from there over the face of all the earth, and they ceased building this city. Therefore, its name is called Babel, because there the Lord confused the language of all the earth, and from there the Lord scattered them abroad over the face of the earth. So God achieved his purpose by confusing their language so that they were forced to separate and fill the earth as he had desired. But I want us to notice something here. What allowed them to maintain their unity in the first place? How were they able to remain a cohesive group? How were they able to be one people as they defied God and what he wanted? Well, chapter 11 and verse 1 gives us the answer. Now the whole earth had one language and one speech. The idea here is they spoke the same language. The idea of one speech is that they used the same words. They had the same vocabulary. They spoke the same thing. Therefore, they could communicate with one another. They could share their ideas. And it helped them to remain one. But now that they were speaking with different languages and different words, this unity was no longer possible. Well, Let's look at today now. What is God's desire for man today and for his people? Let's look over at John chapter 17 and verse 20. John chapter 17 and verse 20. Many of us are familiar with this. A prayer that Jesus is giving to the Father, or is offering to the Father. And he now is going to say something about what he wants his people to be like. He says, beginning in verse 20, I do not say, pray for these alone, but also for those who will believe in me through their word. That they all may be one, as you, Father, are in me, and I in you. That they also may be one in us. That the world may believe that you sent me. And the glory which you gave me, I have given them, that they may be one just as we are one. I am in them, and you in me, that they may be made perfect in one, that the world may know that you have sent me and have loved them as you have loved me. So, unlike the time of Nimrod, and unlike the time of the Tower of Babel, when God wanted the people to separate and to spread out, now we find a time, because that's happened, people have populated the earth, but now God wants his people to come together in one. He wants them to be united, no longer separated. But how can this unity be achieved today? How can we be one? Well, what did we notice a while ago? The way that the people were separated was by confusing their language, by causing them to speak different ways so they could not be united. So now then, let's take the opposite side of that. How do we become united? Paul gives us the answer. Now I plead with you, brethren, by the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you all speak the same thing, and that there be no divisions among you, but that you be perfectly joined together in the same mind and in the same judgment. So, our language and the things that we speak and the things that we say and the words that we use have a direct influence on the unity that God desires for us to have. Over in Ephesians chapter 4 and verse 1. Ephesians chapter 4, actually. Ephesians chapter 4, beginning in verse 1. Here Paul enumerates those qualities of God, those qualities of spiritual things that show unity and that will allow us to have unity. In other words, if we can be unified in these things, then we can be unified as God's people. I, therefore, the prisoner of the Lord, beseech you to walk worthy of the calling with which you were called, with all lowliness and gentleness, with long-suffering, bearing with one another in love, endeavoring, now notice what he says here, to keep the unity of the Spirit. I would suggest the idea here is that the Spirit, the unity that the Spirit desires that we have, in the bond of peace. And notice what he says here, there is one body. Do we see this in the world today? No, we'll find in just a moment that many people think there are many bodies that are fine. He says, there is one Spirit, just as you were called in one hope of your calling. One Lord, one faith, one baptism, one God and Father of all, who is above all and through all and in you all. When we look at God, we see a oneness. We see a unity within the idea of God and a unity that he desires for us to have with him. And based upon that unity, then he says, you need to maintain this unity. How do we do it? Well, as we notice what Paul had to say, we do it through speaking the same thing. Some suggest today that we have many faiths, a multitude of faiths, and you are to find that faith that you best identify. But Paul in Ephesians chapter 4 said there's one faith. Many say, well, there's many different types of baptism. You could be immersed, you could be sprinkled, you could do it as an infant, you can do it later on, you can have the water poured on you. The Bible says there's one baptism. And so if there can be, if in their minds that there can be many faiths and many baptisms, then why not, according to this context, say, well, there could be many gods and many saviors and so forth. God desires unity. And the way that we achieve that unity is unlike the time of Nimrod and the Tower of Babel, in which the language was confused so that they all spoke different things. Now we are to speak the same thing, and that we are to be perfectly joined in the same mind and in the same judgment. In 2 Timothy chapter 2 and verse 2, There, Paul instructs Timothy, telling him to teach others to teach. And what are they to teach? Those things that they come up with on their own? No, they are to teach the very things that Paul taught. They were to teach the same things. They were to be united in the thing that we teach. But today, we see the contrariness of man. In that now, when God desires that we speak alike, many speak many different things concerning God. The idea that denominationalism is good, that you can go to the church of your choice, and that somehow God is going to be pleased with that. Many believe that speaking these different things is somehow pleasing to God. Yet 1 Corinthians 14:33 says God's not an author of confusion. And what we see in the religious world today is mass confusion. People teaching not only different things, but contradictory things. One person says this, and the other person says the exact opposite. And the world looks at that and says, what sense can there be in that? God is not pleased then with speaking the different things, perhaps as he was many years ago. You know, God is not pleased with the contrariness of man. I would suggest, well, we know he was not pleased with the Tower of Babel. He was not pleased with what those individuals were striving to do to keep themselves in one area. And so he found a way to divide them up by dividing the language. Today, God, I believe, is not pleased with the division that we see in the religious world today. God does not want us to oppose him. He wants us to come to him. His desire is that we serve him in loving obedience. Hebrews chapter 5, verse 9, speaking of Christ, says that he became the author of eternal salvation to all who obey him. A part of that loving obedience is listening to his words and maintaining the unity with his children by following those words. It's often been said the reason why we have unity is because we are united with God. And as long as we remain united with him, we can have unity if we were all focusing on what he's instructed us to do. Perhaps you're not united with God today. Perhaps you have not been living a life that would be pleasing to God. You've been living contrary to God. Well, now it's time to change that. Perhaps you're one who has not been looking to his words. You've been going it on your own, thinking that whatever I do, God's going to be pleased with it. And you find, actually, though, you are in a contrary state to God, that you are opposed, you're being obstinate. Well, now's the time to change. Look to his word and obey those words, that you might have unity with him, that you might have the proper relationship with him. If you have a spiritual need this morning that we can help you deal with, whether to ask for the encouragement of this congregation, or if you're not a child of God and you want to become a child of God, we are here today to help you in whatever way we can. Would you come while we stand and sing?